You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, if you're into morel mushrooms, the time is now. Our guest shares advice for how to find them and the best ways to prepare them.
First, in the months since he took the oath of office, President Trump has extended kind words or invitations for in-person meetings to some of the international community's most controversial authoritarian figures, like President Duterte in the Philippines, Russia's Vladimir Putin, and Turkey's President Erdogan.
And recently, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made clear that human rights and other questions of what he calls values will be taking a backseat in U.S. foreign policy after questions of national security and economic impact are answered first.
This casts doubt on decades of U.S. policy, including human rights as a pole star when it comes to foreign policy.
Rebecca Hamilton is with us now. She is an assistant professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. She's also worked in the appeals chamber of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and has been the deputy director of the Bernstein Institute for Human Rights at NYU School of Law. She's the author of the book Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Rebecca, how long has the consensus around human rights and democracy as pillars of U.S. foreign policy been in place?
It has been longstanding. It has been articulated in the current language that we think of as human rights, certainly clearly in the post-World War II era. But, you know, the basic core principles of it go back even further. And importantly, it hasn't been a partisan commitment. You have had both Republican and Democratic presidents understanding the value of America standing up for human rights around the world.
And how has that expressed itself, that belief, that stance in human rights over the years? Can you give us a few examples?
Yeah, so it's been in the form of public statements. You can go back to Ronald Reagan, for example, speaking out in favor of Soviet dissidents. And you can move forward from that. So it's been the use of the sort of what gets called the human rights bully pulpit that an American president has. But it is also, it goes beyond language to actions. And certainly we haven't seen a president actively inviting authoritarian leaders to the White House in the way that we've seen recently with President Trump.
Right. There is that example recently, which is part of what sparked this conversation. President Trump has also congratulated Turkey's Erdogan on an election victory, securing more power for the president. He's been on friendly terms with Vladimir Putin. What does this signal to you about the advancement of human rights in the Trump administration?
It's depressing to me, honestly. It suggests that they see human rights as just sort of one among many chips that can be bargained away as might be strategically useful for any short-term transaction, but not as a core principle that should be guiding decisions that the U.S. presidency takes. And as I say, this is a shift from a long-standing approach in U.S. foreign policy across partisan lines.
And we said earlier that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has said that areas like human rights may now take a backseat. They may be secondary to issues of things like national security and economic benefit, that those questions will get answered first. And that is, in a sense, one way to articulate an America First policy. What signal do you think that might send to governments with a problematic human rights record?
Well, it tells them that, you know, the eyes of America are no longer on them in the way that they have been in the past. Now, I'm not to suggest that by America speaking out on human rights, it's always been any, you know, some kind of perfect deterrent. But authoritarian leaders do watch very carefully what happens in Washington. And I've done interviews with leaders, particularly in the Sudanese government, and they pay much closer attention to what comes out of Washington than many people in America do, looking for signals about what they can get away with. And they will push those limits to the extent that they can. So when you have a Secretary of State like Rex Tillerson coming and saying, this is signaling, this is something that we don't prioritize, then they know that they have a free pass in terms of potential atrocities against their own population.
Right now, we're talking with Rebecca Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Law at American University Washington College of Law, and she's with us to talk about where human rights issues stand under the new Trump administration. And Rebecca, are there gains to be made, for instance, by opening lines of communication with authoritarian regimes? Maybe you have that line of communication and you have maybe more influence.
Look, no one is suggesting that there can't sometimes be gains from keeping lines of communication open. And indeed, cutting off lines of communication has always been seen as an absolute last resort. It's always better to have eyes and ears on the ground and that flow open. But it's one thing to have a back channel of communication open. It is another to invite, for example, President el-Sisi to the White House and actively praise him in the face of the human rights abuses that we know are going on in Egypt, for example. So it doesn't have to be an either-or that you either condemn outright and cut off all communication, or you don't. There is some middle ground to be had, but the Trump administration seems to be going to one very far extreme of that.
And what do you think the U.S. might be risking by backing away a bit from that bully pulpit on human rights on the international stage?
I think we're going to see the impact of it unfold over the longer term, because you may send one signal to these authoritarian leaders, but at the same time, you're also sending a signal to the populations that are living under them. If the Arab Spring taught us anything, it's that the dictators of today won't necessarily be the dictators of tomorrow. And so does America want the populations that are living in these areas to have a positive view of America as someone who has stood up for them in times of trouble, or to have a negative view as a country that has really sold them out in the interest of whatever short-term gains the current administration seems to be looking for? And I think ultimately it is it's a false economy to suggest that you can trade off national security for human rights. At the end of the day, these things feed into each other. And it's entirely possible to have the strongest national security policy as being one that is supportive of human rights. And indeed, when we look in terms of winning hearts and minds of populations, particularly where we're concerned about threats of terrorism, then actively supporting human rights is something that bolsters rather than weakens that kind of policy. But I think the Trump administration has shown a general tendency to undervalue the soft power of American foreign policy.
Once moral authority is lost in an area like human rights and the supporting of democracy, how hard might it be to regain?
We'll see, unfortunately. I think we are seeing that moral authority being undermined, and the question will be, with an eventual change of administration, is a new administration going to be able to sort of close the door on this? Or will a new norm have been established? But certainly, it's worrying.
And do you expect other countries to follow suit now that the United States seems to be advancing an America First foreign policy? Do you expect other countries to do the same? And what does that do to longstanding alliances on these fronts?
So I think there's, a risk with the developments that we're seeing in Europe right now in particular, which is also experiencing the surgence of nationalist populist rhetoric and an undervaluing of commitments to human rights. And to the degree that America is leading that charge, we're going to see this reflected, I think, in some of the statements of European politicians as well. But you're also seeing pushback against it. So I think it's too early to say what the overall impact is going to be. But I think what we can say for certain is that authoritarian leaders are watching these developments very closely and will take as much leeway as they're given by the most powerful countries in the world.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rebecca Hamilton is an assistant professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, and she's the author of the book Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, with us there to talk us about where human rights issues may stand in the new Trump administration. Morel season is here. It's that brief window of time in the spring when people lucky enough to find them at their local farmer's market or maybe out in the woods while foraging rejoice, and then they eat really, really well.
Finding them in the wild can be tricky. Once you have them, the next challenge is knowing how to prepare and cook them.
Tavis Lynch is with us now to share his advice about morels. He's a commercial mushroom forager and cultivator from Cumberland, Wisconsin. He teaches several mycology classes for Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College and is a certified mushroom expert by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Tavis, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Tavis, how did you first get into foraging for mushrooms and growing them yourself?
Well, it started as a family tradition, and as I was finding more and more as I got older, I started selling them to the restaurants, and then that wasn't, I couldn't find enough to keep up with the demand, so I had to start growing as well. I think I started in 2010 or 2011 cultivating.
I didn't know people cultivated morels. I guess it makes sense. How do you get started on that?
I do not cultivate morels.
Oh, you don't?
There's other species that I grow. I grow shiitake and oyster mushrooms. No, morels I just do exclusively in the wild.
So is it possible to cultivate them, or are they only wild grown?
Well, there's a lot of varieties of morels, and there are a couple that can be cultivated fairly effectively, but they're of low quality. They're not a very good mushroom. The best ones you're going to find are certainly the wild-crafted morels.
Now, what I've heard is that you find them near dead trees. Is that true?
It is. The mushroom and a tree have a relationship, and as that tree becomes stressed or dies, that fungus sends up a reproductive panic button. So we're looking for trees that are stressed or recently dead, particularly elms, ash, oaks, and apple trees.
And can you describe a morel for people who, I've seen them, I haven't found them in the wild, I have seen them in the farmer's market and on my plate, but what do they look like for people who haven't encountered them?
Well, it's a tough little thing to describe. They're kind of like a Christmas tree-shaped sponge. They've got a pitted cap surface, and they're kind of slightly triangular. They can get quite large. I've seen them approaching the size of a football, but typically we're looking for mushrooms that are about 4 to 6 inches tall.
That's a great description, actually,
yeah.
A Christmas tree-shaped sponge. And, Tavis, there's a lot of enthusiasm about morels at the markets when you first see them there, in your dinner plate at a restaurant. What is so special about these mushrooms? Why do people go so nuts for them?
Well, I think a lot of that is truly because it's the first edible thing we can find in the woods. We're just coming out of winter, especially up here in the north. I mean, we had snow here a week ago. And it's the first edible thing we can find, and people get excited for that. Another thrill of it is that they don't last very long. You know, the season for morels is usually only 10 to 20 days long. So, and it's a good eating mushroom. I think that there's better mushrooms out there, but the thrill of the first mushrooms of spring is certainly a highlight for people.
You mentioned that short 10 to 20 day season. I hear sometimes people say, oh, it's a good season for morels or a bad season. What is it that makes it a good year or not for a morel?
It's all about timing for temperature and water. Morel fruits, when the soil temperature is between 55 and 62 degrees at 5 inches deep, and if it's not raining through that window of temperature, you're not going to get any production. So we're looking for that soil temperature to rise into the mid to high 50s, usually in early May in the southern part of the state and mid-May up where I'm at. And as long as we're getting rain through that cycle, we will see morel production.
Now, you said a moment ago that there are tastier eating mushrooms than morels, and I have to beg to differ, but I'm not a mycologist. I have never had a better mushroom than a morel unless I don't clean it well and I end up with a mouthful of grit. But really, are there mushrooms you like more than morels?
There is, but that all boils down to personal preference. I've tasted about 160 of our wild-grown mushrooms in Wisconsin, and I wouldn't put a morel maybe even on my top 20, to be honest.
What is on your top 20?
Well, there's quite a few that I enjoy quite a bit more. I really like the bluets. I like a lot of the boletes that come out in midsummer. And there's a few fall mushrooms I enjoy as well.
Huh. Yeah, and these are, I guess, lesser known. I'll say they're lesser known to me. Why do we know morels so much better than those other ones?
I think because because they are so popular in the Midwest, and I think just because of the thrill of people getting out and enjoying the weather for the first time in months. So they're common, they're popular, and they are a tasty mushroom. Don't get me wrong, I love morels, but I think most of it is just the hype of being able to get out in the spring for the first time since, you know, last November.
A lot of years I tell myself, I'm going to go out and I'm going to look for morels this year. I haven't done it yet this year. Is there still time?
There is. I think that the southern part of the state is probably just entering peak production right now. And I'm in northern Barron County, and we're actually just starting to see our first morels. But things you're going to want to look for are dead or dying elm or ash trees, definitely older apple trees. And we're going to want to be looking at eastern and southern slopes. That's where our soil is going to warm up the fastest. So anywhere you see texture on the land, any slope, a mushroom, a morel in particular, needs water, but it doesn't want to have its feet wet. So the more rain we have, the higher up on the hills we're going to look. If it's been a drought, we're going to look lower on the hills where the water table might be a little bit more accessible.
Let's talk foraging safety a bit. Anne from Green Bay wants to know, are there other mushrooms that look like morels but are not safe to eat?
There is a couple of groups that they refer to as the false morels. But what we're really looking for with those is we don't want to eat anything that has a brain-like fold to it. It's going to look more of a wrinkled surface versus that pitted surface of a morel. We're going to want to avoid those. But there's a lot of places that you can send pictures to have your mushrooms identified safely.
We're talking with Tavis Lynch right now, a commercial mushroom forager and cultivator from Cumberland, Wisconsin. He teaches mycology classes for WITC and is a certified mushroom expert by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And we're talking about morel season right now. They're cropping up in farmers markets. You can still find them out there if you're looking to forage. And we'll be talking in a little bit about how to eat them, how to prepare them, and get the most out of your morels. And Tavis, if we want to go out there, I mean, foragers don't give away their best spots. I think it's pretty secret, but you told us a little bit about where to start looking. Can you go to a state park? Is that legal? Or what kind of lands are okay to go foraging on?
Well, I do most of my foraging up here on private lands, but I believe it was opened up in about 2013, roughly, on state lands for personal use only. So you can't go out and forage for sale, but you can go out and forage for your own personal use.
And when you
wild mushrooms.
And when you find them, is there anything about how we harvest them? Is there a right way to pick a morel?
There's an ongoing argument about that, but truly there's not. The best way is to cut them, and that is strictly for cleanliness. So we're not getting a big dirt clod in our basket with the rest of our morels, but pulling them versus cutting them, is the differences there is insignificant.
Okay, and so once you've got your basket full of morels, hopefully, how do you preserve them, and how long do you have until you should probably eat them?
They won't last in the fridge much more than about a week in a container. You can leave them out in the fridge and actually let them dry, but I prefer to dry most of mine. I run them through a dehydrator, or if I just have a few, I will split them in half and make large necklaces and just hang them up outside and let the breeze take the water away. And once they're dried, they'll keep for a very long time.
Well, let's get cooking. What do you do, first of all, with those dried morels?
The dried morels I like to bring back in a simmering cream, and that is my only two ingredients, dried morels and simmering cream. Mm, I just bring them back until they're soft, and it requires nothing else.
Wow, do they disintegrate in there, or do they stay in big chunks?
No. They hold their shape quite well, and if you want to keep cooking it down, you can actually make a very rich gravy out of that.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, my big problem, we just got a small batch of morels. They were actually at the store, and I was really looking forward to them, and I took a mouthful, and it was filled with grit and sand and dirt. How do we prepare them so that you just taste the mushroom and not so much the earth?
Well, and I don't want to try to gross you out, but that probably wasn't grit. That could have been a very small louse that's present on the mushrooms.
No, she's cool. She's not grossed out at all by that.
No,
keep
I'm
going.
All right. I'm totally fine with this.
You can dunk them really quick. 2 tablespoons of salt for 4 cups of water is enough to kill insects. So what we do is we just make a little pan, and then we dunk them just for a few seconds and then take them out. that's not going to hurt your mushroom at all. That mushroom's been out in the rain for 2 weeks. Dunking it in water for 4 seconds isn't going to hurt anything.
And then how about with our non-dried morels, and once we've got the insect life out of them, what's a good way to cook with those?
You know, I don't think you can go wrong frying them up with eggs, but frying them in butter, I think that makes everything good, doesn't it?
Can't go wrong with butter.
Yeah, that's the only way I've ever made morels, and I love it. A little pepper on it, salt, pepper, and butter.
Yep, I say keep it as simple as you can. You don't want to bury it. I see people making pizzas with them and spaghetti sauce, and that to me is a waste of a good mushroom.
I will say I have grilled them, and that's actually my favorite preparation. They get a little bit, as long as you don't burn them, they get a little bit of crunch. And to me, and I don't eat a lot of red meat, it's almost like a mushroom steak. Tastes like steak.
I like that idea. I've never tried that personally. Yeah, I don't see there. The texture of a morel is superior. That I will say I really enjoy. They've got just the right amount of bite to them.
And I got to ask Tavis, this is part of this limited season for gathering morels. Are you getting antsy taking this time with us? Do you want to get back out there and start harvesting again?
I would love to.
Well, we will let you do that, Tavis. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Tavis Lynch, commercial mushroom forager and cultivator from Cumberland, Wisconsin. He teaches a lot of mycology classes at WITC. He's a certified mushroom expert by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. They're talking with us about the fabled morel mushroom.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad.
The political fallout after President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey on Tuesday may just be beginning. The White House said the president made the decision on the recommendation of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, who faulted the way Comey handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails during the presidential campaign.
But Democratic and some Republican lawmakers have questioned the timing and motivation of the dismissal. Comey was leading the FBI investigation into Trump's associates and any potential ties to Russia.
In a written statement, Republican Senator John McCain said that he believed Comey had led the FBI well. He also repeated his call for a special congressional committee to investigate Russia's interference in the election. He said, quote, "The president's decision to remove the FBI director only confirms the need and the urgency of such a committee."
But there are plenty of GOP lawmakers who are not on board with McCain. Joining us now to tell us more is Perry Bacon Jr. He's a senior political writer at 538. Perry, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Perry, this story is changing and developing quickly, but you wrote about Senate Republicans' response to Comey's termination. What's the range? What kind of things have we heard from various Republican senators?
So, first of all, what you've seen from the Democrats is they all have pretty much called for some kind of special counsel or special prosecutor, which would be someone who works in DOJ but is somewhat separate from the hierarchy, who would look into this sort of a separate investigation. So far, no Republican in the Senate is for that. John McCain is for setting up some kind of special committee in Congress to investigate this, but John McCain is alone on this. What we otherwise saw was the members split into three different pretty much equal camps. There were some members who said, basically defended the Comey firing and said it was appropriate. Some who issued comments that were sort of vague to the point where it was hard to see where they stood. The comment was basically like, you know, I wish the new FBI director luck, but nothing about the actual firing. And then you saw about a third of the members, folks like Ben Sasse from Nebraska, Jeff Flake from Arizona, for example. There were about 12 to 15 members who were Republicans who said essentially, I have concerns about this. The president should explain it more. They didn't necessarily condemn the firing, but they didn't necessarily endorse it either, and they sort of raised some concerns about it and suggested they weren't sure the president made the right decision.
And so, yeah, you mentioned John McCain, the only Republican senator, calling for some kind of new investigation apart from what's going on. Do you expect to see other Republican senators join in this, or is this going to be McCain only in this instance?
You know, I think Republican senators are trying to figure out this story's evolving. So I think a lot of the members said Tuesday and into Wednesday, they essentially said, okay, the deputy attorney general, who we just confirmed, who's had a career being fairly nonpartisan, recommended this firing. So that was how they defended the firing in some ways. The news of today where the president essentially said, I made the decision, it was my decision, I was going to fire Comey no matter what, it changes that dynamic a little bit. Members, from what I saw today, Richard Burr from North Carolina, for example, members are sort of wary about this process and how the firing happened, but I don't necessarily know that they know what to say or what to do. They don't want to call for a special prosecutor, but they, I think, want to go a bit there. I think they're trying to figure out how do you express some dissatisfaction with this process without necessarily undermining the president.
Right. It seems like they're a little uncertain to the ground as the story evolves
right.
here. Because the initial, as you're saying, the first kind of explanation was, of what happened was Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, started this process of his own initiative. He brought the report in. Trump listened to that. The president listened to that and went with it. But here's that interview, President Trump talking to NBC's Lester Holt.
Monday, you met with the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein.
Right.
Did you ask for a recommendation?
What I did is I was going to fire Comey. My decision. It was not...
You had made the decision before they came in the room.
I was going to fire Comey. There's no good time to do it, by the way.
Because in your letter you said I accepted their recommendation.
Yeah, well,
so you
also,
had already made the decision.
I was going to fire regardless of recommendation.
So there was really room.
He made a recommendation. He's highly respected. Very good guy. Very smart guy. The Democrats like him. The Republicans like him. He made a recommendation. But regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey.
Now, that's different, again, than this than what we had heard from the president's main spokespeople and from some supporters in Congress. What does that interview do to congressional reaction, then?
It undermines the president's story, and it makes members nervous because they don't, you know, again, we're in a situation where they, and you've seen this throughout these, I mean, the short answer is members are sort of giving comments that are more measured. They're not sure what to say. They've given comments like, I want to learn more about the situation here. Today there was a hearing in which the new acting FBI director was on the Hill, and basically members kept asking him, are you committed to continuing the investigation? Will you handle it in a nonpartisan way? And he said yes. He was asked about the comments from the White House, essentially, that said Comey was not respected by the FBI officers, and the new acting director said, no, we respect Comey a lot. So he came out and again, rebutted the president. So you saw members kind of take those comments in. I still don't know what level of power they really have. Like, it's a decision Trump made, and members can't necessarily dissent from it. So it's not clear to me. And the Republicans don't want to hire a special prosecutor. So if it's like if that's the only thing they can do, they're not going to do that. So it's not clear to me what they can do that's besides the special prosecutor, but still to suggest that they're concerned. And you also have to think about, for Republicans, on the one hand, there's been wariness throughout his tenure from Republicans about Trump's behavior and his conduct and whether and the comments he made about Obama wiretapping him, which were not true. At the same time, Republicans want a conservative Supreme Court. They want tax cuts passed. They want an Obamacare repeal. And Trump has been helpful in terms of passing their agenda. So I think they have some incentives to defend him at times, and they're caught between defending his policies and criticizing his behavior.
We're talking to Perry Bacon, senior political writer at 538, about how GOP lawmakers are reacting to President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that a special prosecutor should look into the Russia investigation? How do you think Congress should be responding to the decision to dismiss James Comey? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Perry Bacon, senior political writer at 538, about how Republican lawmakers are reacting to President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the decision to fire FBI Director James Comey? What do you make of the reaction from Congress so far? Would you like to see Republicans support Trump's decision, or should they challenge him? Do you think a special prosecutor should investigate ties with Russia? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Before we go to our callers, Barry, here's House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican, of course, Speaker. He says he didn't think there was a need to have a special prosecutor looking into Russian interference in the election. Here's a listener's interview with Fox's Brett Baer.
Senator McCain and a few others are calling for a special prosecutor. Obviously, Democrats are in lockstep on calling for that. Why is that not a good idea?
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. We have three investigations going on right now. We have a House investigation by our Intelligence Committee, which is the appropriate committee to do that, I believe. And we have the Senate Intelligence Committee. You just played Richard Burr doing an investigation. And you have the FBI investigating all things Russia.
And we've heard this argument from others, Perry, that, hey, we've got these three investigations. We don't need another. What's been the argument, especially from Democrats, in favor of a special prosecutor?
I think we sort of know that the House committee has had a lot of problems. Of course, Devin Nunes was in some ways coordinating with the White House about some of the intelligence. So the House committee, we're not sure if it's working that well. My understanding is the Senate committee with Richard Burr and Mark Warner is working better. And obviously there are questions now about the FBI investigation because James Comey was heavily involved in it and has now been dismissed. So on some level, the response, I think, from Democrats, and I think appropriately, has been to some extent, do we have three investigations or do we have one investigation that's really functioning at this point? I mean, Ryan's point is correct that if you had three strong investigations going, that would be one thing. It's not clear to me, like the House process, I'm not clear on exactly where it is now, in part because a lot of these investigations are happening in secret, too, so it's not always clear where they are and where they stand, but you do have at least two of them that have had some major problems.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Nate joins us in Coloma. Nate, hi.
Thank you. It's kind of my comment is a follow-up of the previous presenter here. The crucial issue here is that American democracy and the presidency is in crisis right now, and the crisis is around confidence. And without a special prosecutor that is independent of the political process, be it either Democrat or Republican, there will be no confidence in the outcome of whether the Russians actually meddled in the American democratic election process or not.
Nate, I got you, Nate. Thanks a lot for the call. And President Trump said, hey, we had lost confidence in James Comey and he's not alone saying we're losing confidence in the integrity of our elections if we don't investigate this well, Perry.
Yeah, I think there's at least two different issues we're talking about here. One, I think the conclusion is pretty broadly understood now that there was Russian interference in the election. And I think all these committees are investigating that as well. So that's one reason to be not confident of our electoral system, no matter what party you're in. If this hacking happened of one of our major parties by a foreign country, that's problematic no matter what party you're in. You have the second part of it, which I think you're seeing a lot of a partisan split about, both in the Congress and in the public, about whether, one, you believe that allies of Trump had some connection to the Russians, and then, B, how much and how we should investigate that, and how that should be investigated is a different issue. So you have a few different issues in terms of our electoral system being debated here.
Nate, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Sarkis in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hi. I'll just make a quick comment here, but I think that this is a terrifying situation. I agree with the previous caller for our democracy. I mean, here we have elected officials who are supposed to be speaking the minds of the people, afraid to speak their minds about the actions of the president, out of fear of what that might do with their relationship with the president. This should only encourage investigation. This should only encourage digging deeper into this situation. People should not be stepping away from what just happened. We should be stepping and pushing further forward.
Sarkis, thanks for the call. And Perry, this has definitely stimulated even more interest in this Russia investigation. The departure of Comey doesn't put an end to any investigation, does it?
Yeah, the acting FBI director said the investigation will continue. And he said it would not change at all. I mean, the key thing here is we don't really know what happened, because on some level, is there some kind of chilling effect if you're the FBI? Because the narrative of the last few days seems to be that the president wanted Mr. Comey to resign, in part because Mr. Comey was determined to continue the Russia investigation. So that's the question is, we heard today the FBI will continue to investigate, but we don't necessarily know, is it at the same level? Will it be as intense? Is there now worry that it can't really be investigated? So that's why the FBI investigation is important, but the congressional ones are the ones that are important too, because Congress is an independent branch that is not accountable or not required to sort of follow Trump's edict. So we know Congress is separate from Trump. Of course, Congress is still run by Republicans, so you still do have that sort of, you know, partisan team mentality there. So the question will be, we don't necessarily – this is uncharted territory in a lot of ways. The one thing to think about is the comparisons are – and I'm not saying whether Trump did something or not, I don't know. But in the Nixon era, the Democrats ran Congress. In the Clinton era, by the time Clinton was in controversy, the Republicans ran Congress. So you, on some level, you had the other party prosecuting you on some level. It's different here because you have the same party in control of Congress and the executive branch, at least right now.
John McCain, I think, was the one who said, this is a centipede. There's always another shoe that's going to drop. What, Perry, are you watching for? What piece of information are you hoping to get next?
I mean, I'm watching for these investigations. What I'm looking for next is to find out, are these three investigations actually going on? Meaning, are they calling witnesses? Are witnesses coming to the meetings? If you're at the FBI, do FBI agents feel comfortable that they can investigate this? I'm looking less for, I don't know that we're ever going to get some kind of smoking gun that proves something, or that we're never going to get a smoking gun or what, but right now I'm more focused on, are these investigations able to proceed as they would have before? Is Comey leaving just something the president doesn't like him, or was that a way to stop the investigation? I think we'll get some indications of that in these next few weeks.
Perry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Perry Bacon Jr. He's a senior political writer at 538.com. He joined us to talk about how Republicans are reacting to Donald Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey.
One year ago, Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel wrote an opinion that opened the floodgates for high-capacity well permits in Wisconsin. It led the Department of Natural Resources to approve almost 200 well permits that had previously been stalled. Sean Johnson reports on one of them.
Tom Coons bought his house on Pleasant Lake in Washera County more than 30 years ago. His real estate agent, Fred Erickson, has been his neighbor ever since.
I suppose you want your money back now, Tom. Is that right?
As the two sit down for coffee with friends, Coons remembers when Erickson first showed him the lake. Coons was sold.
He put us in his little, his boat with a, 20-horse motor or whatever, and took us around Pleasant Lake. And you could see 15, 16 feet down into the lake.
Erickson says he still takes prospective homebuyers out on his boat, only the lake is a lot lower than it used to be. And Erickson warns people that lake levels could drop even more because of nearby high-capacity wells. That includes a nearby well permit that was granted by the DNR last year after Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel's opinion.
I have a moral obligation, first of all, because I'm your neighbor here at the lake, and I'm a friend to begin with.
But Erickson says it goes beyond that. He says he's professionally obligated to tell prospective buyers, even though it won't help him sell houses.
Yes, I am, because I have information that's pertinent to the property they're buying. And if I don't tell them about that, I can lose my license.
Erickson may feel a duty to warn people about the impacts of high-capacity wells, but the state of Wisconsin no longer operates under any such obligation. Last May, Schimmel's advisory opinion upended the way the state handles well permits. Attorney Carl Cinderbrand represents Pleasant Lake landowners and others who are challenging several wells that moved forward. He says lakes and streams have always been protected by the Wisconsin Constitution's public trust doctrine.
It has always been part of our organic law, and it has been always been very protected by our Supreme Court.
The state Supreme Court issued a unanimous decision in 2011 declaring that the public trust doctrine also extends to groundwater. The court wrote that the DNR has the authority and a general duty to consider whether high-capacity wells will harm lakes and streams. Justices also said the DNR should use its expertise and its discretion to do that. That eventually led the agency to consider the cumulative impacts of all wells on a watershed when considering new permits. Schimmel said the court did not consider new powers lawmakers gave themselves in 2011 over agency rules like cumulative impact. Pressed on his rationale at a recent legislative hearing, Schimmel described his order this way.
Authority for regulatory agencies and rules comes from the legislature.
The DNR had 190 high-capacity well permit applications it had set aside before Schimmel's opinion, some of which the agency admits it was going to have to deny. After Schimmel's opinion, all 190 of those backlogged permits were approved, including one for the well near Pleasant Lake. DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp told the legislative panel recently that lawmakers need to be specific if they want to regulate high-capacity wells.
So here's the big policy question that I think all of you are going to be grappling with going forward. When we talk about things like cumulative impacts, there is no definition to that.
Before Schimmel's opinion, DNR regulators used science and the power that courts had given them to set those definitions. When it came to the proposed well near Pleasant Lake, regulators were willing to grant a permit, but with strict limitations. After Schimmel's opinion, those restrictions came off. The DNR increased the permit near Pleasant Lake from 36 million gallons to 272 million gallons of water per year. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest tells us that the American economy is becoming a broken ladder with a growing gap between the rich and the poor and no way to get from the bottom up to the top.
We'll find out why a Wisconsin Democrat in Congress is holding a town hall in a neighboring district represented by a Republican.
And on Food Friday, we hear all about herbs. We'll meet the Wisconsin authors of a new cookbook that shares great uses for fresh herbs in our cooking and in our crafts.
Plus the weekly roundup of Wisconsin news and a look at the top news stories of the day. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.